It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. UN and humanitarian agencies say hundreds of migrants have feared drowned last week at least three shipwrecks in the Mediterranean as poor people from Africa try to reach Europe aboard vessels operated by smugglers from Libya. The Italian Navy brought dozens of bodies and many survivors to Italian ports, but was unable to rescue perhaps as many as 700 or more in the worst migrant tragedy on the high seas since April of last year. William Spindler is with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
The Italian Navy has been doing a fantastic job. They have rescued about 14,000 people so far this week. But unfortunately, there have been a number of incidents where people have lost their lives. And in three separate shipwrecks, we estimate that 700 people might have died or are still missing.
In the worst incident, a fishing boat without a motor and carrying an estimated 400 migrants and being towed by a larger rubber boat sank. Witnesses say the captain ordered the tow line cut. Most on board are believed to have perished. In northeastern Nigeria, at least five people, including a soldier, were killed. It happened Sunday in the town of Mu, where an improvised explosive device exploded. Meanwhile, President Muhammadu Buhari has reached out to Niger Delta leaders in an effort to quell a surge of pipeline explosions that have contributed to sharp drop in oil output.
I believe the way forward is to take a sustainable approach to address the issues that affect the Niger Delta communities.
From Washington, this is VOA News. Iraqi security forces have surrounded the Western Islamic State-held Fallujah ahead of a full-scale offensive. The Sunni stronghold has been held by IS longer than any other city in Iraq, and the fighters are believed to be deeply entrenched in Fallujah. James Jeffrey is a former U.S. ambassador to Iraq and now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Fallujah is a tough nut to crack. There's still somewhere between 30 and 50,000 residents of the city in there. They've been traditionally more pro-Al-Qaeda than anybody else in Iraq. Secondly, the very presence of civilians, and there are already complaints about the UN and about, you know, Médecins Sans Frontières, I believe, and others about the dangers of using mass firepower. So those are going to be problems. The question is whether they will fight to the bitter end in Fallujah as they did in Ramadi.
Meanwhile, the IS-held city of Mosul to the north is under pressure from thousands of U.S.-backed Kurdish Peshmerga fighters from the east trying to retake a key road linking Erbil to Mosul. The chief negotiator for peace for Syria's mainstream opposition says he is quitting his post over the failure of the United Nations-backed peace efforts to find a political solution to the country's long-running civil war. Mohamed Alouche linked his decision to ongoing military violence from government forces seeking, with Russian help, to preserve the embattled presidency of Bashar al-Assad. 2 weeks of peace talks in Geneva, where UN envoys met separately with envoys from the Assad government and opposition groups, ended in April without a deal. UN Special Envoy Staffan de Mistura says no date would be set for further negotiations. At least five UN peacekeepers from Togo were killed, one more wounded Sunday in an ambush in central Mali. Their convoy came under attack about 30 kilometers from Savare. That's in Opti region. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. The French and German leaders took part in solemn ceremonies in the forest of eastern France to remember the Battle of Verdun, a 10-month battle of World War I that began 100 years ago.
Die gesamte Landschaft ist nach wie vor von den Kämpfen gezeichnet.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel says the landscape appears as before the fight. Verdun, she says, can and must now leave us. It stands for the atrocity and senselessness of war, she said. Some 300 days of fighting claim more than 300,000 lives, both French and German troops. Get more news at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Senegalese court will today deliver a verdict in the trial of former Chadian President Issen Habré.
The prosecutor has asked for a life sentence. I think that would be something the victims would look forward to. I mean, we're just hoping that the judges weigh the evidence and come up with a verdict that reflects the evidence that has been presented.
That's Reed Brody, counsel for the alleged victims of Issen Habré. Uganda's former intelligence chief vows to continue fighting for the political and economic emancipation of Ugandans. And Gambia's president says not even the UN Secretary General can tell him what to do when it comes to human rights issues in his country.
I think the latest statements from President Jammeh are just, unfortunately, a continuing trend of rejection of what is a growing international consensus that the human rights situation in the country is really deteriorating.
Adote Akwe is the Managing Director for Government Relations at Amnesty International USA. Hundreds of African migrants are feared drowned in the Mediterranean, and Cameroon mourns the death of Queen Mother of Bikutsi music. Those stories, plus Mark Oman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A court in Senegal will today, Monday, deliver a verdict in the trial of former Chadian President Issen Habré. Mr. Habré faces charges of crimes against humanity, torture, and war crimes. The trial is the first of its kind where one country's courts are prosecuting the former ruler of another country for alleged human rights abuses. The alleged victims of Issen Habré's regime have been waiting for this day for 25 years. Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch, who is also counsel for the victims, talked to Ricky Stryak about the expected outcome of today's verdict and what the case potentially means for human rights cases around the world.
This verdict is really the culmination of a 25-year struggle by Issen Habré's victims to bring him to justice. And had it not been for that tenacity and perseverance, this case never would have happened. So it's really the for the victims, for Chad, for international justice. Of course, this is the first time that any time where in the world the courts of one country, Senegal, are prosecuting the former leader of another country, Chad, for alleged human rights violations.
And what are you expecting the verdict to be?
Well, the prosecutor has asked for a life sentence. I think that would be something the victims would look forward to. I mean, we're just hoping that the judges weigh the evidence and come up with a verdict that reflects the evidence that has been presented.
Do you think there is any concern that he won't be found guilty, that he won't receive any punishment?
Well, the evidence presented, you know, included hundreds of victims' testimony, the files of Issen Habré's political police that we uncovered 15 years ago that provide a roadmap to how the repression was carried out. Just in those files alone, the names of 1,208 people who died in detention, thousands of documents sent directly to Issen Habré, a handwriting expert confirmed in court that Habré's handwriting was on some of those documents, including, for instance, one that said no prisoner of war should leave the jail other than in a case of death. Now, those are things that the judges are going to consider as they make their decision.
Now, if he is found guilty, is there an expectance on your part? Is it expected that he will appeal? And what does that mean? Because this extraordinary African chambers that was created to try him, created just for this trial, will there have to be another court created if he appeals? Which is expected, I believe, if he's found guilty.
That's correct. Of course, Habré doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the court. He refused to participate and had to be, in fact, dragged into court kicking and screaming. The lawyers who were appointed by the court to represent his interests, we assume that they will appeal if Habré is convicted. And then under the court statute, an appeals court would be created by the African Union and Senegal to hear that appeal.
What are the effects that this trial could have
I think it says to despots and tyrants that, you know, if they commit atrocities, they will never be out of the reach of their victims. And I think even more importantly, it says to survivors and to activists around the world, look at what Habre's victims did. They fought for 25 years and they finally achieved justice. So I think it's a message of hope.
That was Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch and spokesperson and counsel for the alleged victims of Hitin Habre. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. An Amnesty International official says Gambian President Yahya Jammeh continues to be blind to what is becoming a growing international consensus that the human rights situation in the Gambia is deteriorating. This comes after Mr. Jammeh responded to calls by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and Amnesty International for an investigation into the death in police custody of opposition activist Solow Sandeng. In an interview with Jeune Afrique, President Jammeh said no one can tell him what to do in his own country. Adote Akwe, Managing Director for Government Relations at Amnesty International USA, hopes other West African leaders will speak out against the abuses in the Gambia because he says stability and good governance in neighboring countries is beneficial to all in the region.
I think the latest statements from President Jammeh are just unfortunately a continuing trend of rejection of what is a growing international consensus that the human rights situation in the country is really deteriorating. If you recall, Gambia had its universal periodic review over the last 2 years, and there were over 171 issues that were identified by the United Nations and the member countries of the United Nations Human Rights Council that do the review, and Gambia only responded to 93 of them. So, you know, we have all known and seen the president of the Gambia be very frank and very aggressive in defending his record and basically disregarding the calls for reform and change. And what's going on now, I think, is just a continuation of that attitude.
He says here that no one can tell him what to do in his country. He said there people died all the time. So he seemed not to care about what you are saying.
I think people dying all the time is completely missing the point. The government of the Gambia is obligated to protect the rights and of livelihood and health of the Gambian people. What you have here is the Gambian authorities detaining people, restricting freedom of expression, freedom of association, targeting the members of the opposition or even civil society. And of course, the death that we have called for the probe for is just the tip of an iceberg of deaths in custody. And when the government rejects any call for an independent investigation to either prove that there was misconduct by the government or that it was indeed an accidental death, then the government is losing its legitimacy very quickly.
At the same time, we still have opposition leaders like Usainu Dabo and the others that were arrested. There are some people who are saying perhaps Gambia should go before the International Criminal Court.
It's not surprising that you're hearing calls for that kind of investigation. I think human rights groups and other members of civil society are going to continue to push for increased pressure from ECOWAS and from the AU and from the donor countries that work with the Gambian government, and also going to continue to call for an independent investigation.
Do you think the ECOWAS countries need to do more to speak out?
I would hope that they would, because in the end, stability and good governance in neighboring countries is beneficial to everyone. One of the real frustrations and criticisms that you hear from the Gambian diaspora is that no one is paying attention to what's going on in the Gambia. And it really is time for ECOWAS in particular to reiterate that there are standards of governance, international and regional human rights standards that all of the governments in West Africa need to respect and live by. And Gambia can no longer, you know, get a free ride or just decide to ignore them.
Adote Akwe is the Managing Director for Government Relations at Amnesty International USA. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Today is Monday, May 30th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Uganda's former intelligence chief says he will continue fighting for the political and economic emancipation of Ugandans. General David Sejusa said he will continue to build capacity among Uganda's political forces. He was reacting to a Ugandan High Court ruling over the weekend that he is no longer a serving member of the Uganda People's Defense Forces. Sejusa had asked the court to rule on his trial in a military court while he had retired from the army. The judge said Sejusa was entitled to a constructive discharge from the army since he no longer receives a salary and other benefits from the government. The government said it will appeal the ruling. General Sejusa accused President Yoweri Museveni of forcefully keeping people in the military to keep them from being involved in politics and speaking their minds.
The court really reaffirmed what we have for a long time thought to be the case. We are very grateful to the honorable judge who stood up and allowed justice to prevail.
Your case took a very dramatic turn, particularly in the heat of the presidential campaign. Was there a connection between your case and the political campaign?
Yes, there was, absolutely, because my case is a political case. It has nothing to do with the legalities, and it has always been a political case of imprisoning people in the armed forces so that you use military law. Even when we have nothing we are doing there, we are not employed, we are not paid, we are not housed, don't get any benefits, so that you are subject to military law. And once you are subject to military law, then you cannot participate in politics, as they call it. Then you cannot talk to newspapers. Then you cannot complain. So being in the military has become a political management tool for the government in power here.
The judge in making the ruling felt that the refusal to retire you was an act of discrimination. The army is saying that it is going to appeal the court's decision.
There is no problem, because appealing is a natural consequence once you subject yourself to the legal process. The biggest problem is once the powers that be do not interfere with the political process.
Coming to the election, there was some suggestion by Power. You are one of the advisors to Dr. Besigye. He's been charged with treason. What do you make of the tune of the political situation now in Uganda?
Some of us who have been associated with this system a bit and also who know what has been happening, we are not surprised at all. But there is nothing strange that is happening even on Dr. Besigye, because Dr. Besigye has been in prison. Even when I was in exile, he was detained in his house. He's been escorted since 2011. So his circumstances haven't changed, only now that it was, I think, untenable to keep him home. So they had to get a charge which can keep him in Uzira.
What are you going to be doing now that you've been retired officially from the military?
The mission is cut out for me, really. There is nothing new to be done. I mean, people are in prison. I must help with a campaign to free them. There is so much injustice. I must continue with the campaign to reverse things. There is so much poverty in the country. The campaign to make sure that we improve our situation must improve. In other words, my journey continues. So our job is really to make sure that we give our people leadership and we help them and we struggle together and we see how to improve things.
Under what platform are you going to continue to fight for the Ugandan people?
I'm a chairman of Free Uganda. This was formed in 2013 when I was in the United Kingdom. Then when I came here, I joined with other political groups. It's called the Platform to Rescue Uganda. But my job has been capacity building with other political forces.
General David Sejusa is Uganda's former intelligence chief. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. More than 700 migrants are feared dead after drowning while attempting to cross the Mediterranean Sea last week. Thousands more were rescued by the Italian Coast Guard. As Latika Hoke reports, survivors describe abominable treatment at the hands of smugglers.
An Italian Navy vessel with hundreds of rescued migrants arrived in the southern Italian mainland port of Reggio Calabria on Sunday. The Vega also brought 45 bodies of people who perished during the journey across the Mediterranean. The survivors, most of them dressed in white suits, were met by emergency personnel as they disembarked the ship.
We were able to provide medical care to the migrants on board, thanks to the doctors the Navy makes available to us. And we also provided clothing to the migrants, particularly to those who had lost theirs in the shipwreck. We also provided hot meals.
The United Nations commended Italy for the extraordinary effort to save lives.
The Italian Navy has been doing a fantastic job. They have rescued about 14,000 people so far this week. But unfortunately, there have been a number of incidents where people have lost their lives. And in three separate shipwrecks, we estimate that 700 people might have died or are still missing.
Officials say most of the people on board the shipwrecked vessels were from sub-Saharan Africa. Survivors say the smugglers who ran the boats made no attempts to save passengers from drowning.
It seems that on Wednesday night, at least two fishing boats and a rubber boat left the Libyan coast. One of the fishing boats carried around 500 people, and it towed the smaller fishing boat with some 400 people on board. On Thursday morning, the smaller boat, the one that did not have a motor and was being towed, started to take on water. Some people managed to jump in the water and reach the larger boat, and some were even able to climb up the tow line. Very few people. The tow line was then cut and the smaller boat sank.
Italian authorities have arrested four suspected smugglers, including a Sudanese man who commanded the towing boat and allegedly ordered passengers to cut the tow line linked to the sinking boat. According to the UN Refugee Agency, about 200,000 people have crossed the Mediterranean so far this year. And before this latest tragedy, about 1,700 had been reported dead or missing. Zlarissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
After weeks of failure, South Sudan's transitional government of national unity says it has started discussions on the issue of cantonment areas in Equatoria and Barragazel regions. The government's information minister says the Joint Monitoring Ceasefire Commission, or JMAC, has been directed to establish whether there are SPLAIO cantonment areas in Equatoria. Wake Samuwudu has details from Juba.
Information Minister Michael Makuei told the journalists shortly after a cabinet meeting chaired by President Salva Kiir that the cabinet focused primarily on discussing the issue of cantonment areas of the SPLAIO forces in the three regions of Upper Nile, Equatoria, and Bahr El Ghazal. Makuei says they neither agreed nor disagreed that SPLAIO have forces in Equatoria and Bahr El Ghazal regions. However, he says the cabinet has directed the Joint Monitoring Ceasefire Commission, the body charged with monitoring the implementation of the ceasefire process, to identify if there are any SPLAIO cantonment areas in Equatoria.
This is the directive which was given, and because of time, the agenda could not be completed. There were other three issues which were in the agenda, but this is what took most of the time of the cabinet, so the meeting ended accordingly.
No time framework was provided as to when the JMCC would report back to the government regarding its findings on cantonment areas in Equatoria. But Makuei says the JMCC has been directed to immediately begin its work.
It was also agreed that the JMCC should sit down, determine the criteria for selection of cantonment area in Greater Equatoria. As for Bahr El Ghazal, this will be considered after looking into all these issues. Then the JMCC will also be the one to determine. If there are forces over there, then all these issues will be determined thereafter.
Makuei says if the SPLAIO forces in Equatoria are to be given cantonment areas, they must have been involved in combat during the conflict before the peace agreement was signed. Representatives of the government and SPLAIO have been at odds for months over whether to provide cantonment areas for the SPLAIO forces, especially in Equatoria and Bahr El Ghazal regions. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wodo in Juba.
Cameroon is mourning the death of iconic singer Anne-Marie Nze after she succumbed to illness last Tuesday. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé, where fans gather at her home to bid farewell to the 84-year-old artist, also known as the Golden Voice of Cameroon.
Loudspeakers blast the music of Cameroon's legendary artist Anne-Marie Nze, a style known as Bikutsi. She lived in a neighborhood called De La Cité Verte, or the Green City. Fans have been flocking here to pay tribute. Abraham Gwa came with hundreds of members of her university music club.
I grew up listening to Anne-Marie Zay. I grew up dancing to her tunes like Liberté, Liberté. Anne-Marie Zay was the queen mother of Cameroonian music.
Liberté was by far her most popular song. It was a song of rebellion, originally composed in the 1960s as Cameroon and other African countries were shaking off colonial rule. Throughout her long career, Nze used music to advocate for self-determination and defend human rights. She got her start singing in the church choir as a girl, and then began performing in nightclubs as a young adult. Fellow artists say she was a powerful mentor. Ate Bazor is a promoter of Cameroon's traditional music.
When I worked with her on several occasions, we played. The Anne-Marie Zay I met was not the proud type who would look low on the younger artists. She was like a mother.
Zay died just 2 weeks before a concert local musicians planned in her honor, but her golden voice lives on. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's Post. Here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Tanzania held hosts Kenya to a 1-1 draw in a friendly played in Nairobi on Sunday. Earlier on Saturday, Morocco dismissed Republic of Congo 2-0. Mauritania upstaged Gabon 2-0. Nigeria pipped Mali 1-0. And Senegal outwitted Rwanda 2-0. On Friday, Togo edged visiting Zambians 1-0 in Lome. In cricket, hosts Papua New Guinea outplayed Kenya by 6 wickets in the ICC World Cricket League Division 1 tie in the capital, Mosbay, on Sunday. Turning to athletics, Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon and Hyvin Kiyeng set Kenya national records at the IAAF Diamond League in Eugene, Oregon State, in the United States of America on Saturday. A World Championship silver medalist, Kipyegon clocked 3 minutes and 56.41 seconds to run the world's quickest 1500-meter time for the event this year. She improves on her national record of 3 minutes and 56.82 seconds run in Shanghai, China, a fortnight ago. In Eugene, second and third-placed Ethiopians Dawit Seyaum and Gudef Tsegei ran live lifetime bests of 3 minutes and 58.10 seconds and 4 minutes and 0.18 seconds, respectively. Meanwhile, Kiyeng bettered Africa's women's 3,000-meter steeplechase record to 9 minutes and 0.01 seconds. The previous Africa record by Tunisia's Habiba Gribi stood at 9 minutes and 5.36 seconds. Kenyan Asbel Kiprok prevailed in the 1 mile in 3 minutes and 51.54 seconds, with Morocco's Abdelati Igida placed second ahead of Kenyan Elijah Manangoi. Ethiopian Mukhtar Edris edged Kenyan Geoffrey Kamoror to win the 5,000 meters in 12 minutes and 59.43 seconds to Kamoror's 12 minutes and 59.98 seconds. Kenya's William Malel Sitonik was runner-up in 10,000 meters in 26 minutes and 54.66 seconds ahead of Ethiopian Tamirat Tola, Kenyan Stephen Sambu, and Ethiopian Ibrahim Jeilang, who all covered the distance in less than 27 minutes. On the infield, Egypt's Ihab Abdelrahman El Sayed set a meet record of 87.37 meters in men's javelin. Kenyan world champion Julius Yego was second with an 84.68 meter effort. Back on the track, Kenyan Ferguson Cheruiyot Rotich was second in 800 meters in 1 minute and 44.56 seconds ahead of Ethiopian Mohamed Aman, while Botswana's Isaac Makwala was third in 400 meters in 45.37 seconds. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, May 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in. Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.